more and more examples of people who are not hanging it up when they're 50 or 70. In fact, they're stepping into their, for some, their best years. Where we ask people over 65, when was the best period in your life? Unbelievably, 71% said either now or the years in front of me. And that's never happened before, where people reach their later years and begin to think that it's not that I'm on the wind down, but rather I'm, you know, becoming myself.
Welcome to Zestful Aging Podcast, where I speak with changemakers from all over the world, from every walk of life, who will inspire you to live with zest. I'm your host, Nicole Christina, and my mission is to bring you optimism about aging and help you make full use of the new opportunities that only come at this stage of life. And to find out more about this podcast, hop on over to zestfulaging.com. Well, today I am so honored to introduce one of the world's leading thinkers on aging and longevity, and I could read a very long list of his accolades, but let me just quote President Carter. I have been learning from Ken Dykewald for years and am convinced that he is today's most innovative and original thinker on the important subjects of aging and longevity. And boy, you can't get a better endorsement than that. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Great to be with you, Nicole.
I'm so excited. Yeah, I'm so excited to have you here. I just finished your book and there's so much to talk about. There's, you know, it's got everything. It's got nudity. It's got it's got all kinds of interesting stuff. It's got President Clinton and some of his unfortunate actions that led to, you know, some disappointments on your end. But let's start with lifespan. And I think we've all heard about lifespan, and we're starting to hear more about health span. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the difference.
Sure. First, let me give a little bit of the backstory. And your listeners, who I know are highly educated, may be surprised by what I'm about to say. And that is that throughout 99% of human history, according to medical anthropologists, the average life expectancy, the average lifespan, was under 18 years. Hmm. Now, that's because a lot of people died young. Acute infectious diseases, accidents, trauma, childbirth, war. So there have always been a few 50, 70, 80-year-olds, but not really many. What happened during the 19th and then the 20th century was that breakthroughs in medicine and refrigeration, so we can manage and store foods, incredible breakthrough with led to antibiotics, soft vaccine, the arrival of self-care, the ability to do surgical procedures. All of a sudden, people started living 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years. And that has never happened before. And so this age wave, as I call it, is brand new. We can't go back to the 18th century and say, how do they handle, you know, mass aging or elevating longevity then? Because they didn't have to. You know, couples weren't thinking about retirement in the 1850s because they knew they weren't going to live long enough to be retired. So we've got lifespan, and that's the number of years we can expect to live. And of course, nobody knows for sure, but the average jumped 30 years during the 20th century. Unfortunately, it's gone a little bit backwards in the United States during these COVID years. So it's about 76, 77 right now. But let me tell you something. There are 39 countries in the world that live longer than we do. Mm-hmm. So even though we think we're a great nation, and I do believe we are in many ways a great nation, when it comes to health and longevity, we're very mediocre, but the plot gets worse. Then there's what we'll call health span. That's the number of years that people spend in the absence of illness or debilitating disease or cognitive loss. And the United States is ranked 68th in the world. Mm. So not only do we not live as long as folks in Canada or Japan or Germany or all kinds of countries, but we have somehow created a medical system where there's lots of profit and money spent, but we don't live nearly as healthy as we all like to live throughout the last decade or so of our lives. So we got some work to do.
And what would it take? This is a big, big question. You know, the 68th rank, I think some of us who read a lot about this are starting to get you, and also infant mortality. I mean, we've got some, as you say, work to be done. What would it take for us to increase our rank in the health span department?
Well, we could spend a day on this, but I'll just spend a minute. I think there's four or five things that if we did, we would all be healthier longer and probably live longer too. Number one, we need to beef up our science. I'd like to see Alzheimer's eliminated. If we could eliminate Alzheimer's, we would change the whole complexion of longevity. When I was 30, I did a book with Jonas Salk. And why not over dinner? He told me how in the 1940s, a lot of people were saying we need to create more iron lungs that are lighter and more flexible. And his point of view is, no, we got to end the disease. And to our good fortune, he broke through. And in 1953, we had a vaccine. Second, I'm distressed over the fact that about 90% of all the doctors and nurses who graduated last year did not take one elective in geriatrics. So they might be good folks and they might be well-intentioned, but they're making a lot of mistakes. The older body, especially with one or more, what they call morbidities, problems, needs special kinds of attention. And sometimes there's two or three or four doctors and they often don't talk to each other. Third, I think that we need to make the payment for our healthcare system comprehensible. I get a document each month, and on the top left of it, it's from Medicare. It says, this is your Medicare bill. And on the top right, it says, this is not a bill.
Mm-hmm. It's craziness.
And I'm a pretty clever guy. I've written 19 books. And by the way, the book you were referring to is my 19th. And it's called Radical Curiosity, and it's a memoir. It's the only book I've ever written where I've tried to make sense of my own story. But you know, we have a healthcare system that people can't access unless they've got PhDs in healthcare. It's rugged. And last, I'll say that, you know, we got 40% of our population that's obese and 2/3 of our population is overweight. We don't, you know, if you follow the work of Dan Buettner and his Blue Zones, we don't do there's sort of this intention action gap. Most people know what they ought to eat and they know they ought to walk each day and do a little bit of movement and avoid certain foods, and we don't do it. So yeah, that's a great thing about freedom. You get to do what you want, but we don't take very good care of ourselves. And you add all of those things up, absence of competency in a science that's not yet had breakthroughs. I mean, honestly, I've been working in the aging field now for 49 years. And back in the day, I would have thought we'd have breakthroughs and there wouldn't be cancer in the 21st century. There wouldn't be Alzheimer's. There wouldn't be diabetes. There wouldn't be arthritis. There wouldn't be strokes. We would have had major breakthroughs. But instead, we just got more and more people. You know, we have ways that we can help people manage their conditions, but we haven't been able to do away with things. So shame on us.
Yeah. And who is the number one ranked health span? I'm curious. Is it Japan?
Japan.
Yeah. And so they're doing things very differently.
Yeah, they're lean. They eat healthy diets. They've got a medical system that is where every doctor receives education when it comes to geriatrics. They do a lot more things right. And, you know, duh.
And they have culturally, perhaps you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but they're more meaningful roles for their elders.
Yeah, they need to, because they've got such a low birth rate that elders need to play and are respected, that elders have a more meaningful role. I was on that point, I was giving a speech before COVID, and the other speaker was Harrison Ford. And, you know, he's obviously a successful movie star, but he's also a climate activist. And during his speech, there's about 1,000 people in the audience, he mentioned how we need to get all the young people in the world planting trees, save the planet. And everybody gave him a standing ovation. It was an exciting moment. I had a private meeting with him afterward, and after I, you know, fawned over him and told him about all of his movies that I love so much, I said to him, you know, we have 1 billion people in the world over the age of 60, and nobody's tasked them with anything. Mm-hmm. Think about that for a second. Mm. That may be the highest form of ageism, to have 1 billion people of mm-hmm. a certain age and don't ask anything from them mm-hmm. other than to, you know, go home, have some fun, relax, watch your favorite TV shows. And
it's so, like, invisible. It's yeah. like, you're, yeah, yeah, you don't, so, we don't even see you.
On the one hand, people might say, well, I've earned this. Sure. And I'm not saying that you need to work until you're 100 or you need to start a church or a mosque or a synagogue. Mm. But our studies have shown that if people do 3-4 hours a week of helping other people, they mm-hmm. get healthier, they live longer, they're happier, and they're more resilient. But we have not built that into our infrastructure, which has been youth oriented for so many hundreds, thousands of years. And mm-hmm. I think that in Japan and in other countries around the world, they think of older people as elders, and they think of them as folks who have something to contribute. We in the United States have kind of missed that ride.
Mm-hmm. Hi, everyone. Have you listened to my interviews with Dr. Bill Rawls? He's been on the show twice, and after I read his book on cellular health and learned about his high standards for quality control, I was sold. I placed an order for Vital Plant supplements immediately. And I encourage you to learn about his work by hopping over to vitalplan.com. If you enter Zestful15, they will give you 15% off your first order. I'm excited for you to try these products. I think you're going to be very impressed. Now back to the show. And how much do you blame advertising, if you do at all, and some of these images that reinforce that the only way to be valuable is to look young?
I blame it a lot. And I've also, you know, I've worked with many of the great media networks, and I understand what's behind it. And it's out of place. Back in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, people were inclined to form what were called brand preferences when they were between around 15 and 25. And so the idea was that if you had a mass media, like television when it appeared on the scene, you should target people who were around 18 or 20, because if they liked your car, they would drive that brand for life. And if they liked your toothpaste, they would use it forever. If they wore your shoes, they would continue wearing that brand mm-hmm. for life. Mm-hmm. And older people were set in their ways back in that era and weren't inclined to change much. Nowadays, first of all, young people are broke. Mm-hmm. People who are 50 have 70% of all the wealth in our country, and they're reinventing themselves. They think of themselves as entering a new chapter in their life, and they're trying new tech, and they're making new friends, and they're wearing different clothes than they used mm-hmm. to wear, and they're moving their homes, and they're open.
Traveling, yeah. Right.
They're traveling. You know, boomers in the United States alone in the next 20 years are going to have 3.9 trillion hours of free time on their hands. And so how knucklehead for marketers to avoid people mm-hmm. 50 or 60 because of something that got set in motion back in the middle of the last century. So yeah, marketers, AARP has done studies where older people are portrayed 7 times more negatively than younger people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly where our culture gets its impressions of mm-hmm. what could aging be. You know, I'll give you an example. When Betty White passed away about a year or so ago, people were shocked that she was 99. And they thought, wait a minute. I thought by the time you're 70 or 80, you know, you're falling down and you can't get up. Here was a girl who was attractive and funny and caring and playful and had an incredible career that kept evolving. And people thought, wow, I kind of like the idea that I could be 99 and still attractive and playful and interesting and important. And I think we're seeing more and more examples. I'll give you an example as a man. My wife and I went to see Top Gun last year. And, you know, whether you like Tom Cruise or not, he did most of the stunts in that movie. And he was 59 when he shot the film. I went up back to my computer and looked up Cocoon. The lead in Cocoon was that the little old man was Wilford Brimley.
Yes, I know exactly who you're talking about.
He was 49 years old when that movie was filmed.
Wow. So
it wasn't too long ago where 50 and 60 and 70 year olds were very much over the hill. Not the case anymore. I mean, that's no one's going to tell Oprah that she ought to, you know, go sit in her room. And there's Martha Stewart on the cover of Sports Illustrated magazine at 81. Helen Mirren is incredible at 78. But we're seeing more and more examples of people who are not hanging it up when they're 50 or 70.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they're stepping into their best years. We've just done a study, my company being Ageway, where we asked people over 65, when was the best period in your life? Unbelievably, 71% said either now or the years in front of me. And that's never happened before, where people reach their later years and begin to think that it's not that I'm on the wind down, but rather I'm, you know, becoming myself. I'm becoming the best version of myself.
Do you see that for yourself too, Ken? Do you see kind of the years in front of you and wonder who you might become?
You want an honest answer?
I want an honest answer.
So I'm 73 now, and I've been working in the aging and longevity fields for 49 years. I'm doing a lot of thinking about, do I want to keep working as hard, and do I want to keep pounding away? And I'm thinking that I'd like to keep working, but work less, you know, have a better balance between off and on. I also, and this is going to sound a little weird, and people very seldom talk about it, I think when you're young, you count your years from the beginning. You know, my daughter is 36, my son is 33. When you pass maybe 70, you start to count from the end. You know, I may have 10 more summers left to live. I may have 15 more visits with my children, or 20 or 30. And so I'm doing a lot of reflecting. I also know that having been there for the birth of both of my children and been there with my dad when he passed and was holding my brother and I were holding our mom when she passed, that I have more, I'm going to use the word wisdom. People are very disinclined to refer to themselves as wise. They think it's somehow bragging. I don't know. I feel like I've earned some wisdom over the course of the year. And I have more perspective than I ever did. And I bet a lot of your listeners, if they're 50, if I were to say to them, do you have more wisdom and perspective than you did when you were 25? Everybody would nod their heads.
Yes.
And so there's a certain energy and state of mind that you have when you're young, but there's a resilience and a state of mind you have when you grow older. And I don't think we've yet given proper respect and appreciation of the massive amounts of experiences and knowledge and wisdom. I was brought a couple of years ago to a program in Philadelphia where they wanted to show me that they were having older people volunteer, and they thought of themselves as great examples. And I went to this It was a senior center. And I think the word senior is on its way out, by the way. And they had all of these older men and women licking envelopes.
Oh, goodness.
And they thought that was a great example. Look at this. We're having, they're occupied, they're meeting people, they're doing something worthwhile. Mm. And I thought, wait a minute. You've got physicists in that room. You've got grandparents in that room. You've got school teachers. Why not deploy them at the top of their skills and knowledge rather than at the bottom? These are not these are experienced human beings. So we have to dream up what I would call an elder corps, kind of like how Sergeant Shriver and John F. Kennedy created a Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. We had all these young people and we wanted to make them more worldly. You know, we've got a lot of older adults. Only 24% of our retired population volunteers at all. So 3/4 don't volunteer a minute.
And that's a theme that's emerging, Ken, is this theme of volunteering. And we've seen it in the literature, but it sounds like you are a big fan of getting out there and volunteering in a meaningful way.
With an emphasis on in a meaningful way. Okay. I think it requires creative thinking. It requires utilizing. Well, you mentioned Jimmy Carter, for example. I built houses with President Carter. And I was on a habitat build, and I would say 2/3 of the people were of retirement age who were, you know, mm-hmm. shingling roofs and putting in toilets and building buildings. And they were loving it. And I just don't think we take full enough advantage of our older adults. And I also know, like, you know, as you are, being a clinician with older people, that when people just sit around their house, by the way, the average American retiree watches 47 hours of television a week and doesn't volunteer at all. So yeah. I think we've created a kind of a needs improvement version of it, of aging and maturity. And I can picture a world where older people had more interdependence, were more involved with younger people. So a lot of younger people really got the wind knocked out of them during COVID. You know, older people, good thing, had safety nets. You know, the market value of Medicare is about $13,000 a year. The average payout of Social Security is about $20,000 a year. And so that's not going to make you rich, but, you know, it's a safety net.
It'll pay the groceries and the rent.
If you're 22 or 18 or 31 and you're locked in your apartment for a few years and you don't know if you're ever going to fall in love or you can't afford to pay off your college bills or you may not get a job, or, you know, or you're working from home and you don't have any friends, I think that older people could be very valuable helps to younger members of the community, even not their family only, but, you know, people who could use a grown-up or two in their lives.
And, you know, I'm hearing you've been involved at the top level with policymakers of all stripes. Do you experience some frustration in the fact that the U.S. and also the world is pretty slow to adapt to this age wave?
Yeah, I'll say I experience three types of frustration. One, to have a country as great as ours, but to have us do so badly on the aging theme is absurd. And there are some brilliant people in the field. You've had them on your show. How come they're not listened to? And how come we don't scale these great projects to a national level? Second, the media. You know, I've watched every presidential debate for the last 20 years, and I haven't heard a good question yet go at these people saying, you know, for example, we're 68th worldwide with regard to health span. Why is that? And what are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. We ask all kinds of questions, but we don't ask aging related questions. Third, when we have so many old people, older people in office and running for office, they avoid the aging topic because they don't want their competition to think that they're old. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate. I think we need more younger generations thinking and ideas. And, you know, there's a high school debate topic every year that high schools all over the country agree they're going to think about. And I would love to see a high school debate topic for next year be, what's the purpose of older people? Mm-hmm. What could be the purpose? Mm-hmm. And I'm frustrated that we don't do enough creative thinking about what is our only growing natural resource, which is all these amazing men and women who are living longer lives. And I do want to also clarify that it's going to be increasingly a women-run world, as women, if they're partnered with a man in America, their partner is 2.5 years older than them. Mm-hmm. Men pass away, women live 5 to 6 years longer. Mm-hmm. And so as we have an aging nation, we're going to increasingly have it be a feminized nation. And older, experienced women, I think, are going to be taking on more positions of power, controlling money, controlling votes, controlling, you know, public image. And I think we need to get ready for that.
Interesting. I haven't heard too much about that, although there is the famous quote about the world will be run by, women, and I'm not recalling who. Do you remember that? Somebody, I don't know if it was the Holiness Dalai Lama or someone like that, talked about kind of women taking over the world.
Well, it's obvious, and especially boomer women who, you know, different than their moms, went to college. When I was young, 1% of the households, women were the primary breadwinners. Today, it's 30%. Mm. And not only that, but going forward, we're going to see more and more women in positions of power. Now, I understand there's a pay gap, and it's wrong. It needs to be fixed. But for every 100 young boys that are graduating college this decade, there's 130 girls. So the young women are stepping forward to take on positions of influence, power, leadership. And so as we look to the future, we not only will see an aging population, we're going to increasingly see an aging female population call on the shots.
That's very interesting. For our last question, we talked about meaning, and I would love you to tell our listeners about your decision to remarry your wife, your beloved wife, not once, not twice, but 3 times, and what went, you know, what the thoughts were behind that and what it meant to you to do that.
Well, I got married. My wife and I were both 33 in 1983 on Thanksgiving. And we were broke, but we kind of felt deeply in love. And we'd both been single. She'd been married once before. And the night of our wedding, we stayed at a bed and breakfast. And I said to her, "I love marrying you. Would you marry me every year?" She said to me, "You know, people don't do that." I said, "Well, you know, they celebrate Halloween every year. They celebrate Mother's Day every year."
That's your innovative thinking, Ken.
Yeah, why not celebrate the love of a person? And so she said, "Okay, we'll do that, but let's make sure when we get remarried, we do it at a different location with a different religious persuasion." So we've had 39 weddings so far.
Oh!
Not three, but 39, and a 40th coming up in a few weeks. And I will tell you that people sometimes say to me, "How come you do that?" And I say, "Well, how come you don't?" It might only take 15 minutes. We've been married Hopi in Sedona. We've been married at the Chapel of Love in France, Versailles. We've been married at the Chapel of Love in Las Vegas. We've been married at the Chichen Itza Pyramid. We got married Polynesian. We got married by a gay Anglican priest in a castle in England. And the places matter less than we ask each other, not during the ceremony, but in a couple of days around the wedding. "How are we doing? You know, how could I have been a better husband? How could you have been a better wife? You know, we've been through the death of all of our parents. We've been through hard times, been through the loss of money. We've been through good times." And having that punctuation point here allows us to kind of stop and think. And I think a lot of people just kind of rumble through their lives and don't take a few moments to stop and think about what matters. And if you don't have a partner, maybe you celebrate a friendship, or maybe your love for your dog or your high school best friends. You get together and tell them
to be intentional and to be really paying attention to the things that are so important.
Right.
What a beautiful, I love this. And you talk in your book about how your wife has been your steadfast companion, even in the depths of loss and even in the crisis, financial crisis you experienced, that she has always been there and been steady and supportive.
Part of why I wrote Radical Curiosity, and by the way, all of the earnings from my last three books are donated to not-for-profit organizations, so it's not about making money on these books, was that people see me from the outside and hear my lectures or read articles that I've written, but they don't know who I am or what I've been through, and it looks like it's just one great success story, but it's not been. I've gone through very hard times, and I've tried things that have failed, and I've tried things that have succeeded. And what I tried to share in this Radical Curiosity book were the lessons that I've learned. My legacy is more than my life lessons than any stuff I might have accumulated.
And I really appreciated that because it does. I mean, you know, you're a good looking guy. You're as articulate as can be. You got this whole tan glow and the tortoiseshell glasses. You know, you look like $1 million on PBS, hanging out with the highest thinkers. And I really appreciated you saying, hey, you know, when I got some feedback that I looked too smooth or smiling or whatever, it was really hurtful. And I really appreciated your honesty and you know, I'm a human too, and it hurts when people are critical like that.
Well, it is part of life. And, you know, you live 60, 80, 90, 100 years. And I think in the future, people will be living 110, 120 years. So your younger listeners will be the beneficiaries of some breakthroughs that are around the corner. You know, stuff happens. And how do you becomes a mind game? How do you make the most of what you've got and grieve what you've lost and move forward? And I tried to share that. And the lessons that I learned, not only in my own life, but from people like Betty Friedan and Bucky Fuller and Nelson Mandela and Jimmy Carter and all kinds of people that I've had the good fortune of having as mentors in the course of my life. And I think I like to feel that this book is maybe my most important, Radical Curiosity.
Yeah, it's a great book. Some parts of it are just hysterically funny, and then there are certainly parts that are quite heartbreaking and poignant. Ken, are there any last messages you want to leave our audience, our listeners, as they're, you know, they're thinking about how they might be able to age better and what is in the future for them?
Yeah, I'll say three things. Number one, take as good care of your body as possible. When you're young, you can get away with all sorts of misbehavior, but it catches up to you as you get older. Number two, we've done studies all over the world now, and people say the most important ingredient in longevity is not the supplements you might take, but the friends you have. And remove the toxic friends and make some new friends if you're short. And third, seek help. Reinventing yourself, just like you might have done when you went to college, you joined the military, you asked people who had done it, you know, what it was like and what was the best fit for you. A lot of people roll into their retirement and are clueless. And, you know, find a good book, go to a workshop, listen to this program over and over again, not my program, but your program, Nicole. And
hire a longevity coach.
Yeah, or a retirement coach. They're emerging now. And try some things out. If it doesn't feel right, walk away and try something else out. So take a shot at reinventing yourself, knowing that you may not get it right the first time.
Yeah, that's great advice. It really is sort of shopping around for what fits. I think that's such great advice. Ken, it has been such a thrill and an honor for me to speak with you. I know you've paired with PBS in the past. That's one of my favorite organizations. As you know, we're also streamed on public radio, and it's just been a real honor. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.
Thank you, Nicole. Thanks for all that you do.
Thank you so much for joining us on Zestful Aging. If you like the podcast, please share it with some of your friends. Our theme song is All I Did Was Wait for You by Kjartan Abel. Visit Kjartan-Abel, that's Kjartan-Abel, ABEL.com, to hear more of Kjartan's work. And our technical director is Stephen Litweiler.
Hello, Zesties. Well, many of you know that I've been a psychotherapist for more than 30 years, and I'm an expert in healthy aging. But what you might not know is that I'm also a midlife coach, and I help women like you clarify and design the life you want to live in your second half. A life that's vibrant and feels uniquely like you. Maybe you've spent your entire life caring for others in one way or another, and you're a bit stuck with how to move forward in this new phase of your life. Or maybe you're considering a career change or other big life transition. Or maybe you're in the middle of a life change you didn't see coming. You may be asking yourself questions like, who am I now? And how do I build a new kind of life for myself? Or how do I make the most of the time I have left? This stage in our lives is the perfect time to pause, recalibrate, and reassess where our life is heading and ask ourselves what deserves our precious time. Now is the time to focus on what brings you joy and a sense of deep, calm contentment. I love helping women discover who they are in addition to being caregivers. After our sessions, you will have a clear plan for making your life more vibrant and deeply satisfying. You will feel a sense of control because you will be making choices that are perfect for you. And you will feel more confident because you will have an individualized blueprint to follow. And because you're a Zestful Aging podcast listener, I'm offering a special package deal. Contact me at zestfulaging.com right through my contact link. Time is truly precious, and there's no time to waste.
And stay tuned next week for another interview with a fascinating and inspiring guest. See you then.